many times have you thought, I would love to do this or that? Maybe write a book, start a charity, create a kids' puppet show, build a sustainable clubhouse, go on the trip of a lifetime, create a production company. Whatever that thing is for you, I hope this podcast inspires you to believe you can. I'm Karen Vaughan, and this is the Get Off the Bench podcast. Howdy, and welcome back to another week of the Get Off the Bench podcast. This week, I am talking to Rosemary Gattuso, who is a family court mediator. And this conversation is absolutely fascinating. But she's not just that, actually. She also runs workshops in schools. She is a speaker and has a book coming out very soon called It's Not You, It's Me, but is just a fascinating human being. And the conversation today, I know you'll love it. She talks a lot about asking ourselves what's wrong and what's strong. And that, by doing so, how we focus on overthinking, I guess, and criticizing ourselves, and how we move that over into growth and resilience and really finding the joy in ourselves and approving of ourselves and going, you know what, I'm actually a really good person and these are my characteristics and I'm okay. So it's really shifting our focus on, one, how we think about ourselves and how we interact with ourselves, and how we think about others and how we interact with them. So I know you're going to absolutely love this conversation. So let's get into it. So welcome, Rosemary.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I've been looking forward to this chat.
Oh, me too. You've actually got an interesting job, but you're also doing a lot of other things as well. But I'm really keen to, you know, it's funny, we think some people's jobs, oh, I could never do that. That sounds boring. And I'm not saying yours is boring, you know, but we kind of don't know enough about what other people do. And then yes. I always have this thought, you know, we've all got a story. We've all got this life that's going on under the surface, and you know, we're all doing our best. Well, I think we are. So
that's right.
I can't wait to get into that and have a good chat about it. So thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. All right, well, let's not make it too, we were trying not to make it too serious and heavy, but I would like to sort of touch on at the start. You are a mediator for the family court in Sydney, and yes. That would come with, personally, I couldn't do it because it would, I think I would end up in despair, just seeing such, seeing heartbreak. I know that some people choose to go sideways and, you know, like that's enough, we're finished now, but there is still heartache in it. And for you to be dealing with heartache, heartbreak, very often it's got to have some sort of vicarious effect to you. And I don't know how you, well, okay, tell us about your job first, like what you're doing. Tell us how you keep yourself upright, because that's interesting. Yes.
Well, I mean, it's a good point, because it's about sitting with people in one of the most challenging times of their lives generally. So an important thing for a mediator to do, or a mediator for the family court, is to try and have that balanced lifestyle. Mm. And also to use a co-mediated model, which means that there's two mediators for each mediation, because the mediation is about, a third-party neutral, an independent person sitting with two people who are in conflict or need to make arrangements and, you know, need just a little bit of support in getting there. So to sit there and facilitate that conversation. And being, you know, under for family court mediations, it's about not taking sides, not making a judgment. So it's completely opposite to the traditional legal system, but it's also about really putting the spotlight on the children involved and their needs and their interests as well. So it's, you know, my role is not to be biased or take sides, but I do take the child's side in that, yeah. That really leads the conversation. Well, how would the kids feel about this? Or what do they need?
Yeah. Do you feel that, like, you would understand our brain and how we have an amygdala hijack and, you know, and our complex thinking is completely gone when we're in that kind of situation? When you mention about the kids, because people are heightened, do you feel like they, well, I'm not saying that the kids don't matter, but they can't actually reason with the fact that the kids, we need to get down off our heightenedness, and we just need to stop for a minute and think of the kids. Is that difficult? Because I can imagine how heightened they are.
Yes, it can be. I mean, going through separation is challenging on its own. Yeah, going through separation and knowing that you have to have a working relationship with the person you no longer want to live with, then that adds another layer of complexity. And then that's not taking into account what led up to the separation.
Yeah.
I mean, we have no fault divorce in Australia. So it's on one hand, it's irrelevant. And as particularly for me as a mediator, because it's not an evidence-based process, but at the same time, I have to sort of weigh up, well, what's the impact of all the layers on the actual mediation? And that's where I can make procedural changes and sort of acknowledge that, well, maybe it's not the right time to go ahead, or maybe legal advice could help, you know, even up the situation, or take it slow, have a short mediation specifically for what needs to be done in or sorted for the next few months, and then come back.
Oh, so people do keep coming back to try and, wow.
Because kids need change, situations change, people get new jobs or relocate and things. So, you know, or even deciding which school or activities or whatever major, you know, events that take place that really is a change.
Yeah.
So
is mediation court ordered or is it voluntary?
It's a bit of both. So it is voluntary, and that's one of the first things that I will say to clients. But it's also the first step before going to court, and you can't access the family court without a certificate from a mediator, unless there's an exception where there are safety concerns, and you know, people can bypass the mediator and go straight through to family court.
Well, it's fascinating. By the way, I'm still going to ask for those listening, I'm still going to ask Rosemary a few more questions on this, because it absolutely fascinates me, and I really, my heart breaks for the kids in these situations, without judgment of the parents, because we can't always get on. But Rosemary has been doing this for a long time, and she is also doing workshops, speaking, and she has a book coming out. So we will touch on that, because she's really absolutely grabbed this and gone, well, you know, this isn't just a job for me. This is a life that I live to make a difference. So we'll get into that stuff soon. But I just want to point out that it's just not, well, this is just my job for now, you know, and something else, because it's a real, it really matters to you. I'm curious about when I was a kid. Now I'm 61. When I was a kid, a divorce was kind of like, oh my God, you know, like, wow, that kid doesn't, they've got two houses. You know, that was quite a shocking thing. Do you know what I mean? And it was also a thing that people judged, you know, like, oh, well, they must be a shitty family, do you know, because there's a breakup. Clearly that's not correct. And clearly that's a really horrible, back in the dark ages, you know, but that's how it was when I was a kid. Now I see, you know, it's like nearly, well, I can't say nearly everyone, but there's just so many, you know, the kids that are like, we've got a split family. You know, it's just so common. Do you see a common theme to what makes a family break down?
I don't know if it's a common theme, but it's, I mean, this is going to sound really basic and really simple, but people just outgrow each other. So, and what I this is my theory, is that we connect with people, whether or not it's relationships, friendships, you know, anyone we are in a relationship with or connection with, we connect with people who reflect our own sense of self and our self-worth, or they complement that, and they also agree with that to a certain extent. So if we are in a relationship when our sense of self is not as strong, then, and we have a bit of the I'm not good enough sort of view of ourselves, whether or not we, and we won't, don't even know it, it's just how we live our life,
yeah.
then we tend to gravitate towards people who also support the view that we have of ourselves.
Yep. Yep.
And so as we grow and change and experience life, our sense of self also changes.
Mm.
So then if we then, you know, build on our sense of self, then unless the people around us also, you know, they change their view of us as well, then that incompatibility arises. And that's I guess what I believe, where you have even friendships that fall apart,
yeah.
relationships, yeah. whatever the case may be, it's just more obvious with an intimate partner or a partner you have children with, because of the ongoing consequences. You can't just say, well, that relationship's over and that's it.
Yeah. And it is more complicated. And I love what you're saying. And it's, you know, I've seen that myself. Do you know that you do outgrow people? And it does sound simple and a little bit, you know, basic, but it's, you've only got to become awakened to something, you know, one little thing, and then you start to question, oh, what if I did that differently? And then you're right, you know, the reflection of your partner is kind of like, yeah, but I don't want to change that thing. And it's kind of like, but I do, and we should. And I think then that they become, I'm not speaking from experience, or I don't know, understand, I haven't been in it in depth like you have, but it's almost like, you know, it, when one partner wants to grow and then they put it to the other partner and they don't want to, they see it as an attack on them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like, well, now I'm not good enough for you. You know, you just want to go off and do such and such and I'm not good enough.
You think you're better than me.
Yeah. And then it starts this, starts conflict. But I've got a big thing about conversation. Do you know, if we really know how to have honest conversation with people, and we can hold our ground and be assertive, not aggressive, not passive aggressive, you know, and just say, well, this really matters to me, and I'd love it to matter to you too. I'd love us to grow together, you know. But I don't think that that's very common for people to do that. And the other thing is that, because exactly what we're talking about, you know, as soon as you say I want to grow, the other person is like, well, I'm not good enough for you anymore, and it's a personal attack. It's actually really, really difficult, you know, to have. The other thing too I was going to say on that is that when you talk about sense of self, I think it's good, and I say this and I mean this in my relationship, and we've got a fantastic relationship, and I put that down to being friends first and having a lot of honest conversation, saying things even if the other person doesn't like it, but saying it with love. You know, just having those conversations, is that I will say, and I've always said, I love me whether you're in it or not. You know, I want you, but I don't need you. Do you, you know, that kind of thing? And I reckon that takes a lot of self-growth, you know, a lot of self-development to get to that point where you realize that I'm okay on my own and I'm the only person I need, but gee, I want you, but I'm not at the cost of my well-being, you know, that kind of thing.
And it's sort of like there's a scale of our sense of self or how much we believe in ourselves, and that also determines how much we rely on another person to build our sense of self.
Yeah.
And if you look at, say, compatibility, because we've been looking at why people separate, but, well, let's look at the opposite. Compatibility is where there's two people who are on a similar sort of page, wavelength, chapter, book, you know, in their growth, in their own individual growth.
Yeah.
So that, because everyone's different, individual, unique, you know, it'd be impossible to find two people, you know, maybe not impossible, but, you know, unlikely.
Yeah.
So it's more about, are we on the same page? And you know what? It doesn't even have to be the same page. It can be the same chapter. of the book. Looking at it that way.
And also, I reckon the same attitude is that when you get into a relationship, and this very rarely happens, is that you should be bringing value to the other person. Like when I come into a relationship, I add value to that person. Do you know, I'm not taking away from them. So I kind of said like a Venn diagram, and you know, I have me, and it's all kind of like I've got all the things that I love, and then the partner comes in and it's all the things that they love, and then there's this beautiful little intersection in the middle that you do stuff together, but the rest of the stuff is, well, these are the things I love and these are the things you love, and we actually support each other to do those things. Do you know? But
yes,
that's not common, and it's a shame. What's the impact? I really am my. It's going to sound awful. I kind of don't give a shit about the parents, but I do. But it's kind of like, well, you're adults. It's your responsibility. You know, you have to sort yourself out, and that's your responsibility to do that. My heart breaks for the kids because, and don't get me wrong, don't think I don't have empathy or compassion, because I understand it's a shitty situation, but as a parent, it is absolutely our job to take care of the kids, and absolutely our role to guide them to be safe and to become functional adults, you know, functional adults with good well-being. I think that's our primary role as a parent, to that's what we have to focus on. What impact, like what observations have you, and I know your book's about all your observations, I can't wait to talk about that too. What are you seeing about the impact on the kids? Like, how does it change them? How does it impact them?
Well, it's really about the unresolved conflict, because conflict is normal, and it's about how it's managed. And if you just look at situations where there's families who are together, but the parents really don't get along, and it's really obvious and everyone knows, then those children grow into adults. And I guess we all know someone or families in that situation, and we can see the challenges or the struggles that those adults, you know, have had or been exposed to or had to sort of process on their own as adults. So I see parental conflict as a risk factor, because it can expose children to, I'll say trauma is quite a strong word, but it's really about how it's managed as well as the actual child itself. Because what I've seen more and more is that there's a lot of sensitive children out there. Mm-hmm. So you'll have one family with three or four children, and there'll be one who really is not managing. Yeah. And it's unclear whether or not it's the developmental stage, or it's clear that it shouldn't really be the developmental stage. It could be the transitioning through separation, or that they're not managing. So it's quite difficult to actually pinpoint it, but there's definitely a rise in sensitive children. And I know that there's a percent, I think it's around 25%, that are biologically more sensitive and absorb more and are very empathic. And so things can be a lot heavier for them, and they'll take on things that aren't necessarily them. They can be more in tune with their parents' emotions. So that's part of it. But there's also children that are sensitive because I guess we are a result of our early childhood experience.
Yeah.
So if early childhood experience has taught you to be more sensitive because that's what you had to do to survive, or that's what you were shown, then you learn that as well. So that adds another layer of complexity for parents, because if they've got more than one child, then each child really needs a catered approach for them. And that's not always possible. Or if there's a situation where one child isn't showing that sensitivity to one parent as much as to another, so it can even cause a little bit of tension, perhaps, if those parents don't trust each other, they don't see, or they see it as, well, there must be something wrong, you know, with what the other parent's doing, but it's more about looking at it as a system, because yeah. whatever the two parents are doing, that's going to impact. And I see it as, if you see a triangle with the pointy end facing down. Hold on, let me see if I can. I'm looking in my mirror, not mirror, but the screen, thinking, is that right?
Yeah, that's
and
right.
So the child's on the bottom. So each side always impacts each other. So it's also about going through with parents and exploring that. And one way that I do that in mediation is by starting off with a child's needs exercise, where I ask them about their children, their characteristics, what they like, what they don't like, what their, you know, strengths are, perhaps, you know, what their weaknesses. I mean, I don't like to use the term weaknesses, but it's just areas for improvement. And then use that as a base to then get the parents to share what they think their child needs based on those characteristics. So do they need more reassurance? Do they need more, you know, structure and routine? Or do they need both parents to be even more mindful of their language or what they do or what they share or what they don't share? So
I love that. Yeah, that's done. I love that. What could we do? Like, because we know separation is getting more. We know that there's fast growth when we talk about outgrowing each other. Like, people on a search, to grow fast, and so we're seeing a lot more of this. And as Nisha's saying, you know, there's a lot more sensitive kids. What can we do in the first place? Like, is there something that you think while you're going through all this, thinking, oh, if only, and this is not in a judgmental way. Like, I know you're not sitting there going, oh, you idiots. If only you're not that sort of thing. But do you ever sit there and think, oh, if only people could, you know, we wouldn't be here as often. What's that? Oh, you don't know.
That's a tough one. I think maybe if they weren't, people tend to be really hard on themselves, and I think that can also impact their sense of self and what they do or what they don't do, and at the same time they can be hard on the other parent. And regardless of which one is present, that can really have, because it's a judgment, it's the criticism, it's the blaming, and whether or not that's directed at the other parent or even inwards, they can both have quite a dramatic impact. But again, that's also going to be a reflection of the level of personal growth and sense of self. So it's all an individual journey. I mean, it could be that perhaps it's more about getting education in schools so that, kids are taught more about their sense of self, relationships, dealing with others. And that could look at being a preventative rather than doing all those, kind of self-help programs, workshops, reading and things as adults, which is fine.
I agree with you 100%. We raise kids through this ridiculous education system that makes them compete against each other, never feel bloody good enough, question who they are, and then they get out and then they turn into adults, and then we expect them to be functional adults with a great sense of well-being, and it's never going to bloody happen. So I absolutely love that you're saying that, and I just wish it would start happening. You talked heaps about sense of self, and I know you do as a speaker, you talk about sense of self. What is it? Like, how would you explain it in a sentence or in a snapshot? Okay. And how can we, I know you can't tell us, it's a time thing. You can't just say, oh, Rosemary said I need to do this, this, and this, and now I've got a sense of self. Like, that's clearly not going to happen. But what is it? And is there a couple of things we can do to start being more curious, I guess, so that we can focus on it a bit better? More.
Yeah. And I think it's really about awareness and reflection and not being hard on yourself in that process, because maybe one day that process takes longer than other days. Maybe some days it's quicker, and maybe some days we get over that sort of lesson or that hurdle and it stops repeating itself. Yeah. Whereas in other case, in other parts of our lives, it'll keep repeating until we've sort of reached a new level of understanding about that situation. Now, the sense of self, the way that I see it is it's about how much we believe in ourselves. So, and to break that down further, I look at the sense of self being built up by the interactions that we have with ourselves and the interactions we have with others.
Yeah.
And it's really about the quality of those interactions. And I use a strengths-based approach so that all interactions or thoughts, feelings, and actions can be classified as either coming under what's wrong in a situation or what's strong.
Yeah.
So if we break down further, then our interactions with ourselves that focus on what's wrong, they take away from our sense of self and our ability to believe in ourselves.
Yeah.
Interactions with ourselves that highlight what's strong, then they build on our sense of self.
Yeah.
And then I guess the same with interactions with others. If it's focusing on what's wrong, then it takes away from our sense of self. If it's focusing on what's strong, then it builds on. But it's all connected because, as I said, you know, initially that we tend to gravitate towards people who have a similar view of ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the quality of our interactions with others can often be a reflection of the quality of our interactions with ourselves.
And we can often misinterpret that, you know, because we're being validated by somebody, then we think it's strong, even if it's wrong.
Yes, because there's a fine line between, what builds on and what takes away from, because sometimes they're disguised as others or and have a different sort of presentation. But at the same time, they are still adding to the I'm not good enough view.
Yeah.
And where there's that comparison.
Yeah, and it's, you know, even if you go back to the simplicity of Maslow's hierarchy, you know, the bottom level is survival, and it's kind of like you can be in a wrong relationship. You can be having really toxic interactions with somebody. But if your sense of need, your need for survival, if you feel like that you're at risk or you feel like I have to do anything to survive, you're not going to pay any attention to whether those interactions are toxic because you've convinced yourself that they're, which is what happens in a lot of domestic violence situations. You know, it's kind of like, well, I'm safer here, even though I'm not, if that makes sense, you know, so that sense.
It's easier to sort of, well, not easier, that's maybe not the best word, but as humans, we are comfortable with what's familiar, regardless of whether or not that's good or bad. And we get used to situations because doing something different takes more courage and is risky. And it also needs a strong sense of self. We have to believe in ourselves. And when we're in a situation where we're surrounded by people who give us evidence as that they don't believe in us and evidence as to why we shouldn't believe in ourselves, then it's really hard to do anything new or different.
Yeah. I agree. I had a Shab Irgani on my podcast. She's a friend of mine now. She's a wonderful person. She escaped from Iran, and the first time she did it was with her husband, and they got caught and they got sent back and they were tortured and all sorts of things. And then she escaped again, like knowing that she was going to be killed if she got caught. And she escaped with her two boys, had to go through mountains, you know, of snow for days and days with backpack. They got their stuff got stolen, you know, but they finally, after a long, you know, like a long journey, a hard bloody journey, she finally ended up in Australia. And when you talk about sense of self, like she immediately came to mind, you know, like, no, I know what I want and I know what the boys need, you know, and this life isn't for us and we deserve better. And there's not, like, that's rare, you know, for people to put themselves, something has to be really solid in you to put a sense of survival secondary, you know, to moving on. Well, I want to go back to that. I'm just really love that you're talking about wrong and strong and that. And I think that what we do as human beings is we need to be perfect. We don't get it right the first time, we self-punish. You bloody idiot, you know, you can't do this. That narrative just keeps coming back. But we don't need to be perfect and we don't need to get it right. What we need to do, this is my opinion and I think I'm right, is that we need to get momentum in the right direction, you know, and it only needs to be little nudges, a little less of what's wrong and a little more of what's right. And it just needs to be tiny little nudges. And if that train's moving in the right direction, you know, it'll eventually gather momentum and speed. But if we don't have the compassion for ourselves, you know, to just be, if that's okay, I only made a little step and that's okay. At least I'm moving in the right direction. If we can be more like that, you know, we can be kind to ourselves. And, you know, I think that's missing too, this kindness to ourselves. And
there's a lot of, I call it external stimulus.
Yeah.
And that's anything that's outside from the self.
Yeah.
That is distracts us from seeing our own strengths and staying on that path of what's strong.
Yeah.
But once we're on that path of what's strong, it's easier to see the evidence.
Yeah.
But once we go on to the what's wrong path, it's also easy to see the evidence of what's wrong.
Yep.
So it's a constant sort of challenge. And part of that is really rewriting mistakes into learning opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rather than beating ourselves up and not taking further action for fear of making a mistake.
Yeah. Well, we all make mistakes. We're all bloody, we're human. We're all dickheads. Yep. Doesn't matter how good we are. It doesn't matter. You know, I teach a lot of this stuff and yet I still fuck up. Like really, we're none of us are perfect, but it's about the self-forgiveness and going, oh, shit.
Exactly.
I better learn from that. But you're 100% right on, you know, what you focus on grows. And that I just about to publish a journal, a 100-day gratitude journal. It's more about noticing three things, you know, three good things that happened today, three things I'm grateful for, three things I did for somebody else, three things that someone did for me, three ways I looked after myself today. Do you know that kind of stuff? And I think that it's when you focus, it's about your reticular activating system, you know, in your brain. And, you know, I love the brain stuff. It's if you're focusing on, you know, what's wrong with me or what's not going right, I guarantee your reticular activating system says, wow, let me validate that. Let me scan to validate that you are absolutely right. And there's another one and there's another one and there's another one. But the same happens if we go positive and go, you know what? The world's full of kind people. Your reticular activating system goes, oh, really? Okay, well, let me validate that. Oh, there's another one and there's another one. And eventually, exactly what you're saying, it just starts to grow. And you know, we're going to get pulled off it because the world, as you said, the distractions are bloody maniac. They're just, the world is filled. You only got to turn on your phone and bam, disaster. You know, it's like, but I love it. You talk about trauma-informed practices. And I know I'm just jumping back into that for a second, but when you said about trauma and you said it's a big word, I've had a couple of people on here talking about trauma and it's sort of, we've come to a determination, well, I have, you know, after hearing things that trauma is one of those words that people go, oh, shit, the arms were cut off and, you know, I've been through, serious sexual assault and I've been through that. But trauma can also just be anything that's this is my opinion, please, I want yours, like a shock to the body, a shock to your system or something. What do you, how do you explain it?
Well, I see that, well, if we take the stance that our thoughts, feelings and actions are really a reflection of our early experience, then our early experience, or our thoughts, feelings, and actions are clues to the quality of our early experience.
Yeah.
And that can include trauma.
Yeah.
And then trauma for me is more about the impact on the individual rather than a series of events or situations or experiences, because sometimes the early experience doesn't have of what would be considered obvious signs of abuse or trauma, but an individual responds in a similar way. And yeah, that's because their response to external stimulus was, I guess, greater than maybe someone else in that stimulus. And that doesn't, that's no judgment. It's just how I've seen trauma. And for me, it was more obvious when I was working with families. And as I mentioned before, there'd be one child that was maybe responding very differently. And there weren't obvious sort of, you know, signs of abuse. But it was just about dealing with the conflict, having a sensitive child and their characteristics that are more likely to absorb what's wrong in a situation and what's wrong in themselves. And that became their narrative. So yeah, it's anything that happens that really takes away from our sense of self. So anything that gives us evidence as to what's wrong in ourselves, in our situations, in what we do, in how we think, how we look, whatever the case may be, that can have a traumatic effect on that individual. So it's about the impact on their quality of life. And that is shown by the, or I think one of the biggest impacts is the impact on their sense of self and how much they are able to believe on themselves. So it doesn't have to be a massive event or even be something that you would obviously, you know, look at a person's life and think, oh yeah, I can see what happened. It could be that if you're growing up and have a perfectionist parent, and so that could be interpreted as I'm not good enough. You know, and also I guess when you're a perfectionist, then things aren't good enough until it's that level. So there's a bit of judgment and criticism, whether or not it's actually said. But it can be absorbed that way by a child in that environment.
It is about our interpretations. And it's, you know, when you're talking about different kids, you know, I have four sisters, so five of us girls, and we're all so different, you know, but, and I'm the oldest. And it was only just recently the next one down said to me, when you have such a different view of our life growing up, you think it was just all wonderful. And I'm like, I do, don't you? And she says, no, it was traumatic for me. And my parents were like, there was never any abuse. There was never anything that went wrong in that way. Do you know what I mean? But she was traumatized by me. And she said, I was scared of you. I was terrified of you. And I'm like, why did you take till now to tell me why? And she said, because you were just so loud. You were just so loud and active. And she said, I always thought I was going to get hurt. And that wasn't the case. But, you know, and so, and that would never have crossed my mind. That would never have crossed my mind that she was cowering in a corner because I was loud and active. Do you know that? And I was very vocal. If I didn't like something, by God, I reacted, whereas she suppressed. And if that would have come into a court, you know, which my parents are still together, they're very happy. But it would be like, well, what's wrong with that child? You know, what's happened to her? And it's a fascinating thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And so being trauma informed is about being non-judgmental and open, and maybe even showing curiosity as to, you know, what are the reasons that that individual is presenting in that way? Because it's always a clue to their early experience and how they have taken on that experience and learnt what they need to do to survive.
Just while you're speaking then, and I was listening to you, but I just had a little flash come into my mind that I did push her down the stairs in a high chair, and I... Why am I laughing? It's not funny, but and I did take a razor blade to her face in the bath when she was a baby. So potentially, potentially she has every reason to be scared. I would never do that now, but I was such a naughty little child. But I say that. See, I label myself like that, and I'm still bloody naughty. But you know, now I just do it in a naughty kind way. But you know. But, and your book, you've got a book called It's Not You, It's Me. And it's about your observations of everything that, yeah, everything you've seen and what have you. Now, I have to say that it's not out yet and it's coming out in the next week or so. So please go to Rosemary's website, which I'll give you, but I'll give it to you now. It's, how do you say your last name? Rosemary Gattuso? Yeah, I got it. RosemaryGattuso.com. And you can register your interest in it, which I've just done last night because I cannot wait to read it and be informed that when it comes out. And you talk about, in it is a strengths-based, I do want you to tell me more about it, but a strengths-based tool for self-reflection, or some of it is, a strength-based tool for self-reflection that helps guide and shed light on why some are overcome by a personal crisis and while others conquer to overcome it. So I am so curious about that. And before you answer, I don't like talking over you, but I just want to say one thing. I had Amy Loughran on a couple of weeks ago, and Amy is, I don't know if you've seen that show, The Good Nurse, on Netflix. So it was, I had Amy on, who is the true, in real life, good nurse. And she was the one that put Charles Cullen away for 400 years because he killed between 400 and 1,000 patients in hospital while he was a nurse. Now, her and I were talking about this exact topic, is that she fought and fought and fought to grow, you know, so that she could, she did so much work on herself so that she could overcome the trauma of it all, and she had so many questions about, is there something wrong with me? How did I not see that he was killing people? So she knuckled down and did the work on herself, you know, to overcome this. Whereas Charles Cullen had quite a shitty childhood, and his mother died, and everything else, and he chose that. So you're talking about this why intersection is why some people go this way. That was a perfect example of two people who were entangled in this mess, and one chose to completely harm other people, and whereas one chose to completely say, well, I need to save myself so I can save others. So now that I've said all that, I'm curious on your take on that.
Yeah, well, I really draw on the strengths-based approach and using what's wrong and what's strong to classify all thoughts, feelings, and actions. So, and it's about being able to reflect on, you know, current situations, past situations, and even thinking about future approaches, and really put it under the umbrella of what's wrong or what's strong. Because we're going to be closer to one or the other at any given time.
Yep.
So it's about that reflective process. And I guess in my book, I really name or give examples of what's wrong. So it's that judgment, the criticism, the blame, and even staying in the past and not forgiving.
Yeah.
Whereas when we're more on the what's strong path, then we can be more respectful. We show understanding rather than judgment. We have more of a future focus.
Yeah.
We're looking at what can be, what could be, rather than stopping from moving forward because of the past.
Yeah. That's a sense of hope.
It's more empowering.
Yeah. And it's a sense of hope, isn't it, too, there's that thing called paradise syndrome, you know, that Dave Stewart from the Eurythmics, he's one person that has it, whereas I've got nothing to look forward to. That might sound strange for him, but I've got a helicopter. If I want to go to Hawaii, I just go, or I've got a private jet or whatever, whereas the rest of us go, oh, I want to go to Hawaii, I've got to save, you know, I'm looking forward to something. So
that lens, and I see it as, a T intersection. So for every situation, we can either go one way or another, and whichever lens we take will then dictate our view of the situation, and also what else comes. Because, you know, once if we take the road to what's strong, we're going to get more evidence of that. And we're going to feel more comfortable in that and be able to make decisions based on that. And the same thing can be said for the what's wrong path.
Yeah. So it really does come back to a really strong grounding of understanding what we focus on grows. It really does, isn't it? It's kind of yeah. like you've just got to, you, but it's also about faith too. I think if you've always focused on what's wrong and you don't have faith in anything, it's really hard. And yeah. if you get to that T and you go, well, I'm looking down the strength side, I'm looking down the what could be side, there is also an element of, and I'm not talking about religion, I'm not talking about that kind of faith, but there's a faith that everything will be all right, you know, or some things will be all right, or at least I'll survive that. You know, I've always been, and I think this is where we miss, we focus on the little events, and I'm not saying they're little, but individual events of the past, you know, but that time that didn't work, and that time that didn't work. But if we did put that lens on of the past, well, you know what, I'm still here. I'm actually survived. I'm resilient. I'm resourceful. I must be to get to here because I survived a lot of shitty incidents, you know, and here I am. I'm okay. So I do have faith that if I move into the future in a different way, I'm still taking all that with me, you know, the resilience, the strength, the capacity, the ability, what my skills, whatever they are, all those things I'm still bringing from the past, even though they're all things that help me overcome shittiness.
Yeah. It's reframed. It's not about all the things that went wrong and, you know, how other people hurt or upset you or whatever the case may be. It's more about how it built on your sense of self. Yeah. And biologically, we're really primed to focus on what's wrong because that's how we survive. So if you've got what's strong on this side and what's wrong on this side, then biologically we've got safety on this side and unsafe on this side. So we've got that added element that biology can sometimes work against us. And so then when we're on the what's wrong side, then biologically our brain is telling us we're not safe, or there's evidence that we might be approaching a situation where we're not safe.
Yeah.
So let's do what we need to do to survive. So there's also that, plus there's also our early experience. How were we taught to view life? Were we taught to view life from the what's wrong lens or the what's strong?
Yeah.
And then where there is a traumatic impact on an individual, then this approach might feel like 2 steps forward, 10 steps back.
Yeah. Yeah.
And potentially take longer to get to the same point.
Mm. And unfortunately, we haven't got rid of that very, very ancient negative bias brain, you know, and that protective brain, you know, like where we talk about the saber-toothed tigers and that. Well, we're clearly not going to be attacked by saber-toothed tigers. I'm not saying the world's totally safe because there are a lot of fuckwits out there, and let's just be blunt about that. There's some bloody crazy nuts, and we do have to be aware, but it's a difference, I think, between being fearful and being aware. I'm going to make choices. I'm aware that those people are out there. I'm aware that I should not step onto a road. So I'm going to make choices to do better. But when you say we've got that negative bias, it's bloody really, we are hardwired to go, oh, fear, I'm unsafe, someone's going to hurt me, you know.
Then there's a lot of external stimulus.
Yeah,
that's showing us why we live in an unsafe world as well.
Yeah, and you've only got to look at Facebook, and that'll bloody lock it in for you.
Yeah.
So if you want the book, it is coming out. I think what about the 15th or about mid March? Be out by late March. Anyway.
Yeah, by mid March. Yeah. If you just go on my website, there'll be all the updates there, or you can register your interest to be notified of when it's out.
Yeah, please go and register for that, because that doesn't mean you have to buy it, but I think you will anyway, because you'd want to, because it sounds so bloody interesting. But go and register interest, because there's as we've been talking, there's tools in there to help start thinking about a strength-based approach, you know, and start to think, how can I sit more on the strength side? How can I think, you know, what's good about me? What's strong about me? And how can, like we're talking about those little nudges, any little tools, you know, that are going to just nudge us over into the right direction. are great. So, and I reckon this book will be absolutely fantastic. I can't wait to get my hands on it. So thank you. Great. So thank you for writing it. And the other one other thing is you're doing some speaking and workshops. Now, this transforming one of your topics of speaking, transforming overthinking into growth and resilience. What do we need to know and what do we need to do? Because I know, including myself, tons and tons and tons of overthinkers. And of course, we go down that negative spiral and you've got to pull yourself back out again. So how do we transform it into growth and resilience?
Yeah. And again, it comes back down to the what's wrong and the what's strong lens.
Yeah.
Because anytime we are having a thought, I mean, the big example that I'm, guilty of is making negative assumptions. So, that's one way. Because I see overthinking is an analysis of a situation that focuses on what's wrong. If we have an analysis of that same situation that focuses on what's strong, then that's self-reflection.
So when you're talking about what's wrong and what's strong, because we've mentioned it many, many times, is so maybe that's the first step that people can do is when they look at what's wrong, what question are they asking other than what's wrong? Do you know, like, well, how what are they asking in there to move themselves over?
So sometimes we might have a situation where we really focus on, I should have done this or I could have done this. Yeah. I can't believe I did that. So maybe we just need to eliminate the word should.
Yeah.
You know, anything that implies regret in our actions.
Yeah.
Because then that takes away from our sense of self and then makes it harder for us to believe in ourselves and move forward. And so if we have, you know, like I'll give you an example where I'll say, oh, I shouldn't be late.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I am late.
Yeah.
So look at that example. I shouldn't be late. I shouldn't be late. I'm hard on myself when I am late. How can I transform that way of thinking? Well, you know, why is this so important to me? Then I think, well, it's important to me that I am on time.
Yeah.
You know, if I keep asking myself, Why is this important? I mean, this is a very simple example. I'm trying to sort of break it down. So I shouldn't be late. Okay, why does that impact me? Well, because I want to be on time. It's important to me that I'm on time. Why is it important to me that I'm on time? It's important to me that I'm on time because it shows that I do what I say I'm going to do.
Yeah.
Why is that important? You just keep asking yourself why. And then it's, well, if it's a matter of me doing what I say I'm going to do, well, then that goes back really to, my integrity.
Yeah.
And also respect for myself and respect for others. So it's quite, you can get quite a big meaning out of I shouldn't be late or I shouldn't anything, any type of regret. Why is it important? And sometimes to do that exercise, you just think of what's the opposite?
Yeah.
And then ask, it's important to me.
Why?
This is important to me because. Why is that important? It's important to me because. And you just keep asking why it's important.
Yeah. I love, so it's really just the whys. I love that. I do that with a lot of things is why or why is this important? And just keep. So I love that. Flip it over and then just keep asking all the whys. The other thing you talk about, regret. Daniel Pink's got a book called Regret. And part of this is it, regret's a funny thing. Because in actual fact, it's only our imagination about what might have happened. And we don't bloody know. I regret not doing that because if I had have done it, this would happen. But we don't bloody know that.
Yeah.
Like that's just our imagination of what might have happened, you know. So I love it. Actually, I love that explanation. So flip it and then just keep asking why. And I agree with you. By the time we ask 5, 6, 7 whys, we come out with a really, really, really really impactful statement about ourselves and a really impactful understanding of potentially one of our characters, you know, that we're proud of, you know, that really makes who we are, characteristics of who we
and
are.
It's something that we might ordinarily classify as a weakness because we focus on that impact.
Yeah.
If we look at the meaning behind it, then Well, it's part of our sense of self and our strength and what's important to us.
It really shifts it, doesn't it, from blame and shame and all that kind of stuff over to, I don't know, what we, like self-love, like really to pride, I guess, and a positive pride. You know, it's like, wow, actually, I'm proud of myself because I've got great integrity. You know, that matters to me. I'm a bloody good person. I care that I'm not harming others. I care that I'm not.
That's right. Because otherwise it wouldn't be a should.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be overthinking this situation if it wasn't something that was important.
Yeah. And sometimes we just need to say, I'm doing the best I can. And I'm I can't.
That's right.
Done everything.
It's more about that reflective process rather than, say, being on the what's strong path the whole time, because that's unrealistic. It's about what we take and how we can learn from the times when we are on the what's wrong path.
Yeah. I love that. Love that. Righto, guys, get practicing. Now, one last thing, your workshop, you do workshops in schools, high schools called The Strength.
Yes.
And bouncing back. So basically it's about bouncing back from recovery, bouncing back and recovering from adversity and difficulties. And I guess the underpinning word there is resilience. You know, how do I get back? How does that go over? Like, do kids really immerse in that and find, like, can you see them shifting to a little sense of self when you're talking about that?
Yeah. And I mean, I use the same concept of what's wrong and what's strong to help classify, because I find it to be a user-friendly. It's quite easy to then use and start classifying and start seeing situations and thoughts and actions in that way. And I also run the workshops or information nights for the parents of the teachers, of the students and also the teachers, so that everyone's on board. And this is sort of my idea of prevention is better than a cure.
Yeah.
And, you know, giving some tools and approaches that might not be, I guess, the norm for them or haven't necessarily been explored in the past. To help build on that sense of self.
Do you ever hear stories back? Do you ever hear, like, someone comes, send you an email and says, hey, you know that talk you did?
And because I also offer follow-up sessions. Once I've done the workshops, then I have follow-up sessions where the students can ask questions and comments. So there's often, you know, a lot of reflections on how students would have been able to then view a situation differently, not be so hard on themselves, and also not be so hard on others. Because it's about, you know, putting that lens on themselves and also on others.
I love that. And you're right, because when we're hard on ourselves, it's straight away we project it onto other people, and because we've got to find someone to blame. Even if we hate ourselves, we're still going to blame everybody else for it. But I love that they're coming back with a little shift. Well, some kids might be coming back with a big shift, you know, but even, like I say, even a nudge is better than just being stuck.
And even just having the follow-up discussion is quite helpful. And it's they're talking about it. They're thinking about it. It might take a while for the full extent or the full understanding to then be implemented. But that's fine. It's planting the seed.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly right. And then we water it by curiosity and by just self-forgiveness every now and then. You know, it's kind of like, I can't do anything about it. So just, you know, it is what it is. And then be curious about, I love it. And I love the watering the seed thing. I just love that. I just love that. And I don't think people realize how powerful that is. Once a seed is planted, you just get a little bit of water on it here and there. You know, it triggers and next thing you got your plant through. I kind of make it look like a plant growing through your head, but we know it doesn't do.
Yeah.
But I love that, Rosemary. I have absolutely loved this conversation. And, you know, so just we, like I said at the very start, you know, oh, well, I'm a mediator in family court, you know, and that's kind of like, well, a lot of people can easily put a little bot that in a box, do you know, and oh, what, that's a boring job. I wouldn't like to do that. But when we unpack it, there's just so much information that comes from that, do you know, and so many ways that you have found to take that information, like package it into a usable, well, package, do you know what I mean? Into a usable thing and go out and usable but simplistic, you know, so that people can go, okay, well, here's a couple of questions I just need to ask myself and my whole entire life can change. So thank you so much for sharing all that. Now, where can people find you?
Best place to go is to my website, rosemarygattuso.com.
Fantastic. And you're also on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. Yes. So if you want to, I'll put all those in the show notes. But I have absolutely loved this. I cannot wait for your book to come out, and I am absolutely grabbing a copy, and I'm sure other people will. I know I've got some listeners on here who go, oh, I want that too. So that'll be fantastic. So thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. I really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
My pleasure. All right. See you later.
See you.
Ta-da. Oh, guys, that was an absolutely fascinating conversation. There's just, I don't know, I reckon I could talk to Rosemary for hours, if not days, actually, sitting on a couch, having a beer, talking about all the reasons that people behave the way they do and, you know, how our brain works. And we are complex, fascinating beings. We really are. I don't think that we do a lot of things really well, but we've got this negative bias that's going on, and our reticular activating system is telling us to you know, it's scanning to validate everything, good or bad. And we are, I don't know, sometimes I get cranky on the human species, and I think that we've lost our way, we've lost the plot. But then when I have a conversation with people like Rosemary, and I think about that everybody's just trying to stay upright, and we've got so many levels and layers that complicate us so much, it's like sometimes I flip the other way and say, how the hell do humans even stay upright? It's like a minefield just trying to live in this world. But I really hope you enjoyed that conversation. There's a lot of food for thought in there, particularly the what's wrong, what's strong, you know, and as Rosemary said, just look at what's wrong, and then, or whatever you're saying that's a negative thing, flip it to a positive thing, and then start, you know, going through the whys. Why is that important to me? Why do I feel like this? Why is that important to me? What have you? Why? Until you really start to understand, hey, you know what? I'm actually proud of myself. I'm a good person. That's why it's important to me, because, you know, I really care, or I'm proud of myself for this, or that's a great strength of mine, whatever it is. So please go and do it. Also, please go and register your interest in her book, which is It's Not Me, It's Not You, It's Me. Nearly said that wrong. It's Not You, It's Me. And her Rosemary's website is rosemarygattuso.com. So Rosemary. And Gattuso is spelled GATTUSO. So rosemarygattuso.com. And that will be in the show notes anyway. So hope you enjoyed that. I certainly did. And thanks for joining me again this week. And I'll see you next week. See ya. Thanks for joining me. I hope this episode inspired you to take action. If you'd like to reach out, then I'd love to hear from you. info@getoffthebench.com.au. And check out my website, KerenVaughan.com. Otherwise, keep believing in yourself, celebrate the tiny wins, and keep moving in the right direction.